Well, good day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Mark Leach, who's the co-founder of Never Again Is Now, an organisation seeking to combat anti-Semitism in Australia. Mark has an interesting history. He grew up in Southern Africa, trained as a medical doctor, before becoming an Anglican pastor and moving to Australia. He's a very well-read and thoughtful guy who has had direct experience dealing with a wide range of ethnic and religious differences over the years. Today we discuss what he thinks is causing the increase in anti-Semitism in Australia, whether hate speech laws are a good idea, whether anti-Semitism is different to other types of ethnic hatred, and whether there is a way to differentiate between the struggles for national self-determination of different ethnic groups, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Mark Leach, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on it, and thanks for inviting me, and I'm looking forward to this discussion very much.
Great stuff. Me too. You are associated now with an organization called Never Again Is Now, which seeks to combat the rise in anti-Semitism in Australia. What are the causes, fundamentally, of this uptick in anti-Semitism in Australia?
Wow, that's a great question. The immediate uptick has been caused by the terrible events of October 7th in 2023, the invasion of Israel by the jihadists from Gaza. And I would say then the immediate, well, 2 days later, the rally in Sydney on the 9th of October, when the jihadists basically took control of the city, were given the right to illegally gather in a town hall in Sydney. The Jews were told to keep out of the city, and they then marched down to the Opera House, and the police allowed them to let off flares and conduct a really terrible display of anti-Semitism. And there were no consequences for that. So that has given sort of permission, really, to this unholy alliance of the radical left and the jihadist supporting pro-Palestinian Islamists to express their hatred of Israel, of Western civilization, of America, the great Satan, of Israel, the little Satan, and of the Jewish people. So that's really been the trigger for the unleashing of what has always been there under the surface.
How significant are the universities and what's being taught there as a factor in anti-Semitism? I sometimes think that this is predominantly an ethnic dispute rather than an ideological one. And sometimes people in the opinion pages have a tendency to turn it into too much of an ideological dispute rather than an ethnic one. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. For example, the people that you saw down at the Sydney Opera House, were they people that had flooded out of sociology lectures at Sydney University, or were they, as I suspect is the case, from regions of the world which have longstanding animosities towards Jews in the State of Israel?
So the universities are critical. There are two strands that are fueling this anti-Semitism. One is Islamic jihadist theology and ideology, and the other is the neo-Marxist colonial oppressed framing of all of reality. And so you're exactly right. When you look at a lot of the marches and the protests, the pro-Palestinian movement subsequent to October the 9th, at least half of the people protesting are white Australians. And I say white in the broadest sense. They're not Arabs. They're not Palestinians. They're not Muslims. They're generally secular Aussies who've been influenced by this narrative that Israel and the Jews represent everything that's bad and wrong and oppressive. And Hamas and the Palestinians are the plucky oppressed, who are now resisting by any means this extraordinary evil of the oppression by the genocidal, homicidal, baby killing Israelis. Yeah, so it's ideological. It is ideological, absolutely. There's a worldview behind it. It's also theological. I don't think it's particularly ethnic. I don't think that's right. You know, more than 50% of Israel, for example, is non-European background, Middle Eastern, Mizrahi Jews who've been ethnically cleansed from the Middle East. And 20% of Israel is Muslim. So the jihadist insurgency on October the 7th, you know, killed many Muslim Israelis and Druze and so on. So I don't think it's ethnic. I think it's ideological and theological.
But do you think we would have had the rise in these anti-Semitic protests on the street without large-scale immigration from parts of the world that have these long-standing animosities towards Israel and the Jews?
Yeah, absolutely not. No, I think you're spot on. If you, it's a numbers game, and this unholy alliance. You've had the radical left have been anti-Semitic since the time of Marx and particularly Stalin. I mean, on the far right, you know, obviously a lot of anti-Semitism up until, you know, probably 1948 was really driven by the Christian theology and ideology. That's not been a problem in Australia. You know, Europe and the US has a kind of Christian, in inverted commas, white, right-wing anti-Semitism. In Australia, it's been left-wing on the university campuses, but that's been fringe. Now it's been mainstreamed by the large-scale immigration from Lebanon and the Middle East, with the resulting Islamic jihadist ideology permeating it. 100%. You're exactly right. So immigration has massively contributed to this. Yeah.
One of the proposed solutions to anti-Semitism in Australia has been the introduction of hate speech laws. Where do you stand on that? Are they a good idea?
My theory of change is that politics and legislation are downstream of culture, and what we need to do is make it culturally unacceptable to be anti-Semitic. So, you may be a bit young for this, but I certainly remember many years ago how we used to talk about gay and lesbian people in Australia and in Africa where I grew up, just the casual homophobia, just the way they were referred to. And that casual homophobia then led into rare but not infrequent attacks like physical violence towards gay people, gay bashing on a Saturday night, that sort of thing, right? Mm. What's happened over the last 30 years is that kind of speech has just become, and that the whole way of conceptualizing the LGBT community has become completely culturally unacceptable. So we don't actually need legislation, or legislation is only effective to the extent that it supports that cultural transformation. So with anti-Semitism and hate speech, my great concern is that what we have is that hate speech can be used to shut down free speech. And actually, I'm almost a free speech absolutist. Like, I think we need very strong protections for free speech in a civil society. I think the best antidote for jihadist ideology and the radical left that fuels anti-Semitism is to expose those ideas to searing public critique, where as a whole society, we resile from those and say that is, those ideas have no place in a civil society like ours, and free speech is critical for that. At the same time, so I think any incitement to violence should be illegal. My preference in terms of legislative response is particularly the jihadist hate should be prosecuted under sedition laws. So whenever an imam, a sheikh, or a jihadist calls for the implementation of Sharia law in Australia, that is actually a call for the overthrow of our democratically elected government, and they should be prosecuted under sedition laws rather than hate speech laws.
Yeah, I think people are genuinely torn on this, but I'm like you. I think, you know, should we really be, for example, banning the silly little swastika and Nazi salutes? I can understand why they're offensive, but I also think that the best remedy is something like that Mel Brooks movie, you know, Springtime Hitler, right? Like, isn't that, don't you grant them too much power by saying these are so powerful that they can't be shown, rather than allowing them to be open and then being able for people to identify those that are, you know, starting noxious fears?
Look, I think it's really complicated. So for me, I laugh those things off. I'm with you. I'm in the Mel Brooks end of, but I know in the Jewish community, I mean, I also know how incredibly offensive and triggering and damaging they are. And I also know that they allow those words and symbols, like the way we used to talk about LGBT people or indeed Indigenous people or new migrants, that language does, there's a continuum from what's allowed and thinkable and allowed to be articulated. There is a move from that into violent action. And so it's very tricky. I'm very concerned about any constraint on free speech, but I recognize that's in one sense, it's complicated, because isn't it true? I mean, there's always a trade-off between freedom and security, isn't there? So this is no different. Mm-hmm. We all give up certain freedoms in order to have security, whether it's at a personal level, the social contract that I let the government introduce laws, like where I can drive and what I can do so that you don't kill me and I don't kill you and we all get along. But that does limit my freedom. So maybe it's, as Thomas Sowell says so famously, that in life there are no solutions, only trade-offs. So what we need is a sensible, calm debate about the trade-offs around freedom and security when it comes to speech. Yeah, and I will always be on the side of free speech, yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. And I'm quite persuaded by articles that I've read that have highlighted that, you know, during the Weimar Republic, there were actually hate speech laws and people cracking down on anti-Semitism and the like, and that actually obviously, you know, wasn't successful to say the least. And I try to say to some of my friends of all political persuasions, but particularly those on the left, like, you know, not that Donald Trump is Hitler, although some of them pretend that he is, but clearly, like, prosecuting and putting him off Twitter and everything else didn't push him out to the sidelines, right? It actually kind of made him more successful. So I think that's the risk with these things, and I do worry a little bit that will be the unintended consequences of it, right?
Yeah, no, I think, and you're right to worry. I think you're exactly right. One of the core component of Sharia law and the Islamist agenda, Muslim Brotherhood agenda to influence the West is to roll out blasphemy laws. So in Islam, in Sharia law, it's to criticize the Prophet or to criticize the Quran is blasphemy, punishable by death. And these laws are used all around the world to persecute mostly Christians, actually. So, in Egypt, in Pakistan, and places like that, the blasphemy laws are used in a terrible way. And it is a Muslim Brotherhood agenda to get blasphemy laws enacted under the guise of free speech, of hate speech and religious protections in the Western world. So my big concern is, and that's a real problem. So, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm an Anglican pastor, I'm also Jewish. Mate, if you want to make fun of Jesus, like just look at the Mardi Gras the other week as an example, you want to criticize the Bible, you want to burn the Bible, go for your life, and then let's have a discussion about why you're doing that and our competing worldviews. We want the freedom to expose Islam or cultural Marxism to the same level of both critique and humor and satire. And I think that's vitally important. And I worry that hate speech laws will be used against us to stifle debate. And we'll lose the culture war then, because it's a cultural change that we're after, right?
Hmm. Just shifting gears slightly, it's often said that anti-Semitism is the oldest form of hatred. And clearly that is likely the case in Europe. But I've read other conservative writers like Thomas Sowell that you mentioned, and Amy Chua, who's a professor at Yale and is actually a mentor to J.D. Vance. And they tend to have argued that whenever you have a successful minority within a larger population, like the Indians in East Asia, like the Chinese in Southeast Asia, you'll get this phenomenon. Do you think the anti-Semitism is a unique thing, or is it different? How do you characterize it?
Yes and no. Scapegoating of successful minorities is a feature for sure. So, just think of the Tutsis in Central Africa were regarded as the Jews of Africa, successful and then hated by the surrounding Hutu and then massacred en masse, right? So, and the examples you just quoted are right. Indians in Uganda were driven out. And so we have within us as human beings this extraordinary capacity to hate each other and do great violence against each other. However, the Jewish people have been uniquely subject to that throughout their history. And maybe the reason for that is they've also survived. So they've been driven out and lived as minorities in other countries since the Babylonian exile in 587 BC. For thousands of years, Jews have been persecuted. They've had to leave their homeland, been persecuted wherever they've been, fled endlessly. So when we say it's the oldest form of religious hatred, well, it's because it's the oldest minority group that continues to exist and continues to be persecuted and has been persecuted and driven out wherever they are. I step back and dig in even deeper. And again, this gets into sort of the religious perspective as a Christian. When I read the Bible, you see this. I think there are real spiritual forces of evil that are directed against God and directed against the Jewish people, as in the Bible story, God's chosen people. And so I would say the deeper explanatory layer is a spiritual one, which obviously not all of your listeners are going to agree with, and that's fine. So I think there's multiple levels of explanation. And so it's both true that it is the oldest form, but it's also not true in that there is a lot of persecution of minorities all around the world. And in fact, more Christians are killed by Islamist and jihadist attacks than Jews are all around the world continually at the moment.
I struggled to ask this question succinctly because everyone can talk for hours on it, really, to provide a proper explanation. But if someone says, I understand the Palestinian cause because, they had their land taken from them and Israel is more powerful and dominating them. So why shouldn't there be naturally a sympathy for that? What's the broader explanation or response to that?
Read the history of the region and realize that simplistic explanations like that don't work. That's the very short answer, to which is deeply unsatisfying.
No, I appreciate that.
Very few people are going to do it. In our world at the moment, the idea that the Palestinians are this plucky little minority oppressed by big bad Israel, that is only possible when you zoom in and you look at the current, you have a picture from the late 80s and early 90s with the first and second intifada, where you suddenly see armed Israeli soldiers in tanks and Palestinian teenagers throwing rocks. Okay, so you go, okay, that looks terrible. And then you extrapolate, there's been an unbelievably successful media campaign by the Islamists and the PLO and the surrounding Arab states in conjunction with the post-colonial neo-Marxists in our universities and our mainstream media, shall we say, to frame it all in those terms. But you step out and you go, actually, Israel is this tiny sliver of land with a tiny Jewish population who are surrounded on all sides by the most successful and vicious colonizers the world has known since Genghis Khan, i.e. the Islamists, who have over 1400 years captured all of the Middle East and North Africa and ethnically and religiously cleansed all of those lands up through to Iran and down into... So actually, when you step out, you go, that narrative falls apart because you've got a small little indigenous community who have had a continuous presence in their homeland for 4,000 years, who against all odds after 2,000 years return, have a negotiated settlement, internationally recognized existence of the State of Israel in 1947, independence formed in 48. The Arabs are offered a part. They're offered, if you want to live in the land, here's the land. In the same way that India and Pakistan were separated and partitioned after the war, same thing was happened. The local Arabs and the surrounding Arab nations rejected that because they were fundamentally opposed to the existence of a Jewish homeland in the Middle East. And the violence against the Jews and the opposition to the land predates 47, 48. You know, I had this discussion with a cab driver and he's saying, well, you know, it's all about the State of Israel. Before that, the Jews and the Muslims lived happily in Palestine. And I said, well, just go and Google the Hebron massacre of 1929. There's a whole history of pogroms and persecution of Jewish people. So, read your history. It's much more complicated than we think. And I think the Jewish people have tried to, all they want is peace. Israelis want peace. The Islamists around them want to eradicate them and drive them out of the Middle East. So therefore they have to fight for their survival. But they are the plucky underdog. They are the quintessential indigenous oppressed group who have cast off the colonists of the Ottomans and then the British to establish an independent homeland for themselves. And I think we should applaud that.
How do you, I've got Irish heritage, and how do you distinguish between nationalist movements to establish an existing state, like the Jews did in Israel, like the Irish did, like the, you know, and using a broader lens, the Italians, the Germans, all these other people. How do you, and often those struggles did involve quite bloody kind of fights, right?
Yep.
But is there a way of distinguishing movements like that that should be admired and those that should not be? How do you distinguish between the two?
That's a great question. Does every ethnic group deserve their own homeland? And how do you work that out against colonial empires? So the history of the world is the history of people movements and conquest. So to make it even more pertinent, you don't have to go back to Ireland. Though actually, I was in discussion with an Irish guy the other day, and I said, well, the Jews were just more successful at getting the British out of Israel than the Irish have been at getting the British out of Ireland. And then we had an interesting discussion following on from that. Well, is Ukraine right to resist Russian imperialism? Well, yes, in my view, let's go. Should are the Kurds right to resist Turkey? Should there be an independent Turkish nation, a Kurdish nation? Well, I think they should. So then you go, what are the boundaries and the limits of a nation state? And are they necessarily ethnically defined? And how do we structure ourselves to grant maximum freedom to people to define their own, to determine their own well-being? And I guess then you'd look at the historic claims and connection to a particular bit of land. and you'd look at the means by which they want to accomplish that independence and freedom and the organize. And yeah, so that's such a good question.
It's like what you say, there are plenty of peoples around the world. You know, not everyone wants their homeland. Some do. The Sikhs in India, like you said, the Kurds. There are plenty of different sort of smaller groups of people that, you know, may not actually have the capacity, given their circumstances, to form part of a viable independent nation and would do better within a different sort of framework. I think you can distinguish the Irish struggle against the dirty Brits with the Palestinian cause, but I think all these things need to be taken on their merits. And you know, and one of the key things is looking at whether a nation can actually survive as a viable sort of proposition on its own. That's one factor. It's a complicated subject, and as I know, yeah. Hopefully, I'll ask an easier question now.
This is really important. So, in the narratives, like even in Australia, if you listen to a Lydia Thorpe, for example, in Melbourne, should the indigenous community of Australia rise up in a terrorist insurgency against the white colonial oppressors? Well, and if not, why not? So maybe what I'd say is, I think you mentioned this, take every case at its merit, but it means you've got to think and read and understand the history. And the problem is these things get propagandized, right? So, and people go neatly, or this group's all bad, this group's all good. And you just go, life really doesn't work like that. It's way, way, way more complicated. So I'll give a very controversial example, maybe. Maybe it's not controversial. And for you, it'll be Zimbabwe. So that was where I did a lot of my growing up. Okay, so when I was there, when we moved there in early 70s, it was Rhodesia. There are very few people who would argue this. The fact of the matter is your average African, black African living under white colonial rule or a largely white government in Rhodesia, their standard of education, their healthcare outcomes and their economic outcomes and in some ways even their political freedom was greater than it currently is now under the regime there. Mm. You go, okay, well, what would have been better? Independence fueled by China and Russia in the Cold War? And I don't have an answer, except it's just not simple. And it's the drive to simplistic, propagandized answers to complicated questions that actually make sensible conversations difficult and make foreign policy difficult and make politics difficult.
Yeah, one of the examples I often use when these anti-colonial kind of discussions is Hong Kong, where I used to live. I mean, would it have been better that the Chinese, majority Chinese there, were ruled over by Mao Zedong or some, you know, fuddy-duddy British administrator? I mean, I think the answer speaks for itself, right? And Hong Kong know that. But at the same time, there's also the argument that, you know, it's a powerful thing to want to be part of your own sort of gang and to make your own mistakes, even if you might be arguably ruled better by someone else. I do understand that sentiment. Well,
the other thing I'd say is, to quote John Mearsheimer, who I'm not enormously, you know, an offensive realist foreign policy, Mearsheimer's view that, which I find his insight that I learned from years ago, that we live in an anarchic world order. So between nation states, there's no overall authority to kind of help the kids share the toys in the playground nicely, you know. So one of the considerations in an anarchic world order is, how does a little ethno state secure the security of its citizens? Because the history of the world is that bigger countries will invade and take over and maybe with the winding back of the international rules-based order policed by the United States since the Second World War, it's going to become even, that question is becoming more critical when larger states are, and so are going to want to do what Russia has done in Ukraine and China has done in Hong Kong. And so then how do you, what's the optimal size and structure to be able to guarantee the security or defend your population? So it's all great to have your little ethno state. Yeah, yes, we're free until our neighbors who are bigger and stronger than us invade us and subjugate us, and then we're not free again. So that's the other thing to think about.
Yeah. To move on to hopefully simpler questions, because these are really quite complicated but interesting questions. There's a federal election coming up in Australia, and there's a suggestion that the Jewish community, because of what's seen as Prime Minister Albanese's less than effective response to these anti-Semitic attacks, will move and vote more for the coalition. Are you seeing any evidence of that? Do you think that is likely to occur?
Yeah, absolutely. It's likely to occur, and it's also likely to have not much impact on the outcome, because they're a tiny bloc in a couple of electorates. But they've certainly, the level of distress I have experienced in amongst my Jewish friends in the Jewish community that I move about in the country, by people who've been bolted on Labour left supporters, or even further to left, Green supporters, because a lot of the Jewish community is kind of instinctively and historically progressive and left-leaning. And what they've discovered since October 7 is the only people who've been standing with them and supporting them are the conservatives, center-right and further right, and the conservative Christians. Even a lot of the progressive left-leaning Christians have abandoned them. And, you know, so that's been incredibly distressing when your tribe, who you've given enormous amounts of money and time and energy to, abandon you and side with people who are intent on destroying you. That's been very distressing. So I think I have no polling data. My anecdotal experience of lots and lots of conversations is there's been a shift, like conversations where people have said, I've voted Labour for the last 50 years. I will never vote Labour again. For example, in the recent state by-election in Paran down in Victoria, there were over 100 Jewish volunteers campaigning in a campaign to put the Greens last. The Jewish community has never been that engaged in politics, and now they are.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I've heard different things as well. Like, I mean, in the last U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump, despite being pro-Israel in many ways, actually lost the Jewish vote significantly, right? About 70%, I think, voted for Kamala, which was out of step with the rest. In other countries like the UK, the Jewish vote does vote traditionally very conservative. And then in Australia, my impression is it has been a bit of a mixed bag. You've got as many different opinions in the Jewish community as you have in Christian community, right? It will be an interesting. Why do you think in the U.S. the Jewish community didn't vote for Donald Trump like other groups did?
I don't know. I don't know where you heard that statistic. I thought there'd been a bigger switch to Trump, but
there was a switch, but he still lost the vote overall.
Yeah.
I mean,
the Jewish, I would say. There's a whole.
It tends to be the more Orthodox Jews which vote Republican, and the more.
Yeah. So the conservative religious Jews went right and voted Republican and came up to vote. Maybe some of them for the first time.
Yeah.
In places like New York, the Haredi, the Chabad guys all came out and voted. The Jewish community in the U.S. it tends to be East Coast. It's the big population centers, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, which are all historically hardcore Democrats. And the Jewish community has been progressive and Democrat. So I have no answer. But I'll tell you a conversation I had with one of my cousins, who very smart, thoughtful, intelligent, Jewish people living in the US, they absolutely hate Trump. I mean, with the visceral Democrat, if you think of all the rhetoric you heard, it's hard to, and yet they would say Trump is, he's great for Israel, but we hate him. I don't understand that. All the commentators opine on U.S. politics and U.S. attitudes. We are not the U.S. and I don't understand that attitude because I don't think of Trump as Hitler. I don't think he's that bad. I think the polarization in the U.S. is out of control, and the lack of sensible center has evaporated. Certainly on the Democrats, there seems to be. So I was astounded at that conversation, but I think that's what you're referring to. And why that's the case, I have no idea.
One of the things that I think, I appreciate, and I think even critics of Israel at some level appreciate, is that its sense of national identity, I mean, they respect it, at least I don't appreciate it, but they respect it. No one can deny that they have a sense of nationhood that is stronger than exists in, I think, Australia and the West today. How do we improve our sense of national identity and nationhood in Australia?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. Israel is the most extraordinarily multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic country. But as you say, there's a very strong sense of what it is to be Israeli. Whereas in Australia, I don't think we have a strong, as you say, a strong sense of Australianness and a loyalty to this country. Okay, so where does that come from? Well, if you go through school and you're taught all the time that what we live in is a result of terrible evil and oppression, and we need to continue to be sorry for it and apologize for it, it becomes very hard to feel a deep sense of belonging and ownership to this entity. So there's that. I think we've lost confidence in our whole Western civilization project. The elites have led us down their line, and partly it's because we're so deeply Christian, by which I mean we look at our civilization and we see so clearly that it's not perfect. You go, well, yeah, it's not perfect. But then we lose perspective on what an extraordinary achievement it is and how much better it is than many alternatives, and that the way then to improve it is not to tear it down or hate it, but to love it and to relate. We should relate to our nation state. This is quoting G.K. Chesterton, who's, he's an anti-Semite, but a conservative Catholic and a very interesting writer. So Chesterton said we should love the church, speaking of the Catholic Church, we should love the church the way a woman loves her husband, which is to defend him against all comers, but spend the rest of her life privately trying to improve him. And I think that's the recipe for a healthy nationalism, which is to say, this country we have is worth defending against all comers, civilizationally, militarily, economically, and so forth. And to say, this is amazing what we've accomplished. At the same time, acknowledging fully that there's a lot in our history and in our present that we could do better at. But we do it from a place of deep love for this country. So that's the bigger picture. In Israel, what unites Israelis is their military service and the fact they are in a continual existential battle. So the IDF, their national service, unites them all. It's the absolute equalizer. To serve in the IDF is highly honored and esteemed across all population groups. So when you go into the military, and everyone does, when you go in, you will be, it doesn't matter if you're, Ashkenazi background, so European background Jew, whether you've come from Ethiopia or you've come from Persia or wherever you've come from in the world or the United States, you are together and you have to learn to love each other, in the best sense of the word, trust each other, work together for your survival. So what should we do in Australia? I've been saying this for ages, and it's never going to happen, but I'll put it out there for your listeners. I think we need national service. I think we should conscript everybody to spend 2 years training, doing good, working together, device-free, get the young people off their devices, get them out of home, get them away from their protective parents, get them mixing with people, it's a great social leveler, and train them how to fight, build in them a sense of, you know, love for this country, and then deploy them to do lots of good in the country, and then regularly call them up to serve in camps going forward. I think that would be great. And I think it would do. And then you'd put them off going to uni. You'd have to do that before going to university. So then you'd get away from this problem where you have a whole bunch of 18-year-olds whose frontal lobes haven't developed, making dumb choices to study stuff at universities that where they accrue lots of debt. They keep them out of the labor force, so the government's labor statistics look good, but it does them no service at all. They chop and change. They leave with $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 of debt and a completely useless half a degree, or maybe even a complete degree. So wait until they're 23, 24, they've been out, they've learned how to fight, they've learned a love for this country, and then they can learn a trade while they're in the military, because you can actually learn useful skills. And then on the other side of that, you can make a choice about your tertiary education. I don't see any political party advancing that as a policy, and I think most of your listeners would go, that's just crazy and it'll never happen, but that would be my answer.
Yeah, I think it all sounds possible, except banning social media from, because I don't even think the IDF, I think they allow their soldiers to TikTok and stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I know. With varying degrees of, damage that they do them.
You, for people who aren't aware, you have an interesting background, and I read around a bit, but only probably understand half of it. I mean, you clearly have a Southern African accent, and you're and you have family, I believe, who are actually members of different religions, and your mum was Jewish, and so it's all. To try to summarize shortly, maybe give us a sense of your kind of journey. How did you get to where you are?
Look, in summary, Mum was a German Jew. Her family fled Frankfurt in 1938, ended up as refugees in a little country called Swaziland, now called Eswatini. My father was a white South African Catholic background, so I grew up, and their both families were secular, so I grew up Jewish and Catholic. I said double the guilt. My dad was a mercenary, smuggled emeralds and diamonds. My mother was a doctor. So complicated at many levels. Grew up in Zambia and then Zimbabwe, Rhodesia through the war. So my background is Jewish, Catholic, in the context of sort of post-colonial Africa, insurgency, civil war, diamond smuggling, medicine. I then became an Anglican through an encounter that I had with God at a little Anglican youth group in Cape Town that I went to meet girls. So I met girls, but I also met God. That changed my life. I studied medicine, then decided to leave medicine to pursue a call into Anglican ordained ministry, came to Australia, studied theology in Sydney, married an Australian, and stayed here. And I've spent my life trying to work as a physician of the soul, and a teacher of ideas, telling the better story of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, and this better story of a Christian worldview and of Western civilization that is so unbelievably good for us. And that's all come into focus in terms of combating anti-Semitism here post October the 7th. So that's the potted history. And then my brother along the way converted to Islam. So I understand Islam from both an academic perspective. I've been very concerned about it since 9/11, read deeply on it, then my brother converted, so lots of personal conversations. Mm-hmm. So I'm a walking little bundle of intersectionality.
it's interesting that you came out of that environment where there were lots of competing kind of claims, religious and ethnic and other things, and then became a you know, always, well, maybe it's a stereotype, but a middle of the road kind of Anglican, you know.
Yes. Who knows why life works the way it does? I don't think I'm a middle of the road. It's an accident of history that I ended up there. But I'm an odd beast in the sense of the mix, and that for years has made it quite uncomfortable in many circles. I don't really fit neatly into little stereotypes. But that seems to have put me in a particularly good place to speak into our current moment culturally and socially. So that's what I'm trying to do. Yeah,
no worries. Because you're from history in Southern Africa, I sort of do have to ask. I mean, there is another persecuted ethnic group, the white African minority, and the Indians and others in South Africa that are under under threat. Let's put it that way. How do you think it is possible for their cause to be better appreciated in Australia and other Western countries? Because I feel like they're not put in the same category as the Yazidis or the Rohingya or even the Jewish community, as well as someone, as a group worthy of protection and sympathy and all the rest of it.
Well, the problem white Africans have is the same problem Jews have, is in the current cultural imagination, they are the all-powerful, all-rich oppressors, even after 30 years where they peacefully gave up power in South Africa and have been fairly relentlessly persecuted since then. They're not seen as worthy of protection because they're seen as having power and money. And a lot of them do have money, that's for sure. There are very disturbing, extremely disturbing trends in South Africa when you look at the language of the scapegoating and demonization of white South Africans by people like Julius Malema and the EFF, but also the ANC. Thoroughly racist. I would say now, so my nieces and nephews are still in South Africa, I think South Africa is more intransigently racist than it was during the worst years of apartheid now.
Yeah, right.
It's extraordinary and tribal. Yeah. And here's the other thing that people don't know about South Africa. The people who regularly, there are regular sort of mini pogroms against migrants from the rest of Africa. So the local Africans will go through a township and there'll be an upsurge of violence where they'll kill the Nigerian migrants or the Zimbabweans. So it's a very, very violent context. What do we do about it? Well, I think Trump's made a start, hasn't he? Elon Musk has made a start by highlighting this on his platform. And again, it goes to your point earlier that people, we need to look at things case by case and think about what's really going on. Of course, the problem with that is most people in Australia are focused just on surviving. They're probably, you know, maybe you and I spend a lot of our time reading and thinking about the rest of the world and these ideas. Most people spend most of their time, in my experience, thinking about the job they've got to do today to get money to pay a mortgage, where the interest rates are going up, they're massively stretched, they're struggling to keep their marriages together under all kinds of threats, they're trying to raise their families, all kinds of challenges there, and just survive. So most people aren't thinking deeply about post-colonial Africa and the challenges of a impending genocide against white Africans in South Africa, which is a terrifyingly real possibility of pogroms and genocide against white Africans. Unthinkable, but the history of the world shows us genocides generally occur when neighbors, people you've lived peacefully next to for 50, 60, 100 years turn against you. This was true in Central Europe in the Second World War. Like a third, a quarter of the Jews massacred in places like Poland and Lithuania were killed by their neighbors. Certainly true in Rwanda, where Hutus would turn against their Tutsi neighbors. It's true around the world. So that's a long answer, and I don't know what we do about it.
Yeah, well, the goal has to, even though people are focusing on the cost of living and all that sort of stuff, you do, it is not an irrelevant concern avoiding what happened in South Africa or Eastern Europe and all these other places, right? So, which brings me to your organization, Never Again Is Now. It's worth explaining what you are doing there and what you hope to achieve and how people can help out if they want to help out.
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is ensure that the Jewish community in Australia remains safe and free and prosperous. And the way we want to do that is by renewing our broad cultural commitment to Western civilization and liberal democracy, the cultural and social conditions that have enabled the Jewish community in Australia to be free of persecution up until this current moment, to be pretty much free of persecution since they arrived on the First Fleet, and particularly since the Second World War, when all the refugees from Europe arrive. It's been a haven of peace and prosperity and safety for the Jewish community. So we need to recapture that. And the way to do that is by working for cultural renewal, to say, strengthen our commitment to free speech, to freedom of religion, to the better story of Christianity, of our Judeo-Christian heritage, strengthen our commitment to a pluralist democracy, to the separation of church and state, to stand against the radical left, to push back the forces that would undermine that civilization, the jihadist Islamists, the radical left, and the handful of the kind of far right authoritarians. So we've got chapters around the country. We've got about 33,000 people engaged around the country. It's been a remarkable journey, working, bringing Jewish folk, Christian folk, other supporters together, getting to know each other, advocating for this cause. And I'd invite your listeners to go to our website, neveragainisnow.com.au, sign up for our newsletters, join the movement for renewal and to make sure that anti-Semitism is unthinkable in Australia. We're doing all kinds of things. We're planning for early in April, we're going to run, our plan at the moment is to run simultaneous rallies across the capital cities under the banner Australians Against Anti-Semitism. I figure every Australian should go, hating the Jews is not something we should do, but we're seeing that on our streets, Bankstown Hospital, firebombing of synagogues. I mean, stuff that is, outrageous. 2 years ago, who would have predicted this, right? Anyone who's studied jihadist Islam probably could have, but we've got a major challenge here. So Australians, let's stand together for the kind of pluralist, liberal democracy, Western civilization that we all want to see our grandkids inherit one day. And we need to go into fight for that now.
Yeah. I mean, I like to say to people that, Australia's probably the safest place in the world for Jews in the 20th century. And actually probably the place that had the least ethnic conflict in the entire world during that time, at least an arguable case that it can be made for that. Hey, Mark, I've really appreciated chatting to you look forward to catching up in the future. Are there any other ways that people, if they want to find out more about you and your work, can get in touch or outside of Never Again Is Now?
Get in touch if you want. I mean, I don't know, if you want me to come and speak to your group or one of our speakers to come and speak and run seminars. We've got a corporate program to help educate you people in your workforce around the issues we're facing. But the website's the easiest point of contact, or all the socials in Instagram, Facebook, the regular stuff. Just stay in touch, join the movement, it's about, and for me, I keep saying this is a 20-year battle we're in, right? Like we want Australia. My big goal is that Australia remains a beacon of the very best of Western civilization, so that we're a country where Australians, where every Jewish person can be safe and free and prosperous, and we remain an unshakable ally to the state of Israel. So that's what I'm working for the next 20 years. And if that resonates with any of your listeners, jump onto our website, sign up, connect, reach out to me. I'm happy to talk to anyone anywhere about this.
Cool. Thanks very much again, and look forward to keeping in touch in the future. Cheers.
Brilliant. Awesome. Thank you so much.